Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
We want a rock to cling on to, right? Because life is challenging. Life is difficult. And we're raised on Hollywood movies and novels where if you have a really great idea and a great dream, you'll eventually work hard and overcome your obstacles and achieve that dream. And when you run into real life and you see that things are complicated and not everyone wins and life is difficult and sometimes there's a lot of loss in life, that doesn't fit that story. So if someone is out there with obvious credibility signifiers telling you that there's an A plus B plus C mechanism for achieving your dreams, and that person has done that, and that person looks like a superhero, we want to believe that. It feeds a lot of our insecurities and a lot of our fears.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance.
UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Mike, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
A pleasure to be here. I've been a longtime listener.
Yeah. So I always absolutely love it when, longtime listeners become guests, because to me, it's like the biggest compliment in the world that they've actually done something with what they've learned on the podcast and from all the other information they consumed. So you have a new book out called The Hype Handbook, which we will get into. But before that, as a longtime listener, you know that I don't want to start by talking about the book, but I want to start with what I think is a very relevant question to the book. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school, and how did that end up impacting the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
So even though I am 43 years old, which I guess makes me Generation X, I was sort of an odd duck in that I was kind of like half nerd, half punk rock kid. So like I was weirdly obsessed with doing well in school and getting into a good college. I don't know where that pressure came from, but I was that kid who sort of made himself a little bit sick trying to get A's. At the same time, all of my heroes were derelicts and scumbags, because I loved really rebellious art. So I kind of had all of my friends from the honors classes, and then I had this other group of friends who were like, you know, the kids who drew dead Kennedy symbols on their sneakers. So I certainly was not a jock. I'm not a very good athlete, but I sort of fit between those two groups.
So, I mean, over the course of your career, like, how has each one of those groups influenced, you know, who you've become, where you've ended up?
It's funny. I think that intersection is exactly where I sit. On one hand, I'm still very ambitious and care about extrinsic motivations or extrinsic motivators. So, I didn't sacrifice everything to become a novelist, even though I still love to write fiction. I have tried to really master business so that I can turn, you know, my interests into money. At the same time, even the book that we're going to talk about, I've always looked at unconventional sources of both inspiration and education that weren't sort of just, you know, readily apparent. The people who were kind of the losers and the loners and the freaks, I always have been throughout my whole career curious about what they had to offer. So I think I use that combination every day.
So there's something you say later on in the book which really struck me. You said, when I was a freshman at the University of Pennsylvania, I went from being a highly driven, Ivy League bound academic star of my high school class to a lost and lonely kind of guy. Early in the year, I realized what had kept me moving forward for so long was an obsession with getting into a top college. Now I'd achieved my goal, and I couldn't figure out how to best take advantage of actually being there. And I think the reason that struck me so much was because I felt like I had such a similar college experience. You know, I've read books written by other authors who were at Berkeley at the same time that, you know, I was there. And it sounds like they're describing a completely different university. I'm like, this actually was possible. So why does that actually happen to so many people? Like, why is it that, you know, we get there and you're like, oh, you have this smorgasbord of opportunity, you know, to meet people, to have life experiences. And instead, what you do is you check boxes that, you know, hopefully will get you a job.
It's funny. Before I kind of tell my story on this, I want to say that one of the reasons I like your show, and I'm not saying this to blow smoke, is because unlike so many of the sort of productivity, creativity, business gurus out there, you always talk about the struggles, the emotional struggles you've had and how you've wrestled with these things. And I feel like so many of the gurus out there, I listened to their experience in college, how they like built six robots and landed, you know, a mission to the moon while they were taking an MBA and a degree in Spanish. And my experience was nothing like that. And I used to feel very bad about that because I don't know if I can speak for other people, but I can certainly speak for myself. I mean, I had this overriding goal, and I look back now on how important it was for me to get into a good school. And I should go into some sort of analysis to figure out why I cared so much, but I did. And when I got there, I thought my life was going to flower. You know, I was going to have fun, do interesting things, be a mover and a shaker. And I just sort of didn't find my groove. I didn't have that North Star. I was in the college and it was kind of like, okay, I know that I'd like to become a writer, but getting good grades in college doesn't really lead to that. I also know I'd like to be financially successful, but I don't want to go to Wharton, which is the business part of the school I went to. There are clubs that I tried out for, like drama clubs, that I wasn't quite good enough to get into. And I just like sort of floundered. It was actually, college was difficult for me. I made very good friends, but I did not have a good experience in college for the most part.
It's kind of funny you say that. I can kind of relate because I always kind of wonder what it would be like if I went back to Berkeley now, armed with the knowledge that I've gained from all the books that I've read, movies that I've seen. You know, my ongoing joke is that if I went back to college now, I would approach it like Van Wilder. I would basically join every club that I could because I'm like, this is like a breeding ground for social opportunity.
Yeah.
And I feel like I completely overlooked that.
I mean, I remember one of the saddest things that happened to me in college. I was with my friends in our dorm on a Saturday night, and they're still friends of mine, but we were amusing ourselves by prank calling the radio station and doing accents and weird things. I don't know. Yeah. And we thought it was so funny. And then at a certain point, the DJ goes, "We have a show. What's your excuse for being inside prank calling us on a Saturday night?" And it was like the perfect comeback, but I was like depressed for a week. I was like, this guy is absolutely right. Why am I prank calling a radio station in college at 20 years old on a Saturday night? Like I'm certainly no Van Wilder. I
mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I wonder about this because, I mean, I think part of the reason that that sentence struck me was one, because it was UPenn. And I know that UPenn being an Ivy League school probably has a lot of similarities in terms of the types of people who end up there to Berkeley.
Yeah.
And what I wonder is how much of your experience do you think was the byproduct of the environment you were in versus, you know, just you as a person?
I think it was, as with so many things in life, a mixture. I mean, I think despite the fact that I found lifelong friends at Penn, we had an off-campus house. We did our own thing. The thing about Penn, at least when I was there, I graduated in 99. And I think I heard another guest say on your show say this about their school. It was very fraternity-driven. That was like the center of the social life. And also, even Ben Franklin founded the school to be a pre-professional school. So like Harvard and Yale were like divinity schools and taught the classics. And University of Pennsylvania was started by Ben Franklin, who's the ultimate kind of practical guy. And so Wharton and engineering are everything there. So even though the English department is fantastic, it was number 8 in the country, you're kind of looked at as a second class citizen if you're not in Wharton, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know, the combination of the fact that I wasn't into fraternities and that I was an English major, I was like a bit of a weirdo there. And it's funny that I don't know if I even dated a Penn girl my whole time. I would like date girls like outside of the school. And when I finally went to New York, which is what I did right after that, it was like all of the things that made me weird in the rest of my life before that were suddenly very cool. And I started to sort of flower then, like when I first went to New York City after college. So I think it was a combination of the two. You know, I'm from Philadelphia and I moved to Miami when I was 9. So I think part of the thing was I wanted to go back to Philly because I missed it. But I don't think it was a perfect fit, you know, as a school.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can relate as far as Berkeley goes. But, you know, so you mentioned you started to flower right after you graduated, and you sounds like you really started to find your groove. I didn't, you know, until probably my early 30s. Like, what do you think it is that separates a person who starts to find that groove, you know, in their 20s versus, you know, the one who's in their 30s? And then, you know, what do you say to, you know, the young college students on the verge of graduation listening to this, feeling somewhat directionless?
Well, To make them feel better, I would say I flowered in terms of fitting in socially and creatively. I did not flower professionally. So, I mean, the first thing I did when I left Penn was I started a rock band, and my parents were extremely upset about that. and we had quote unquote success in that we had a big following and all of this stuff, but we weren't making money. My father would regularly have what I called closed door meetings every time I would go back home, where he would tell me basically how I was screwing up my life. So I met a lot of girls for the first time, you know, and they were very pretty because it was New York, and I had a lot of fun, and I was writing cool songs and playing cool music, but I wasn't professionally flowering. So I guess the one thing I might tell someone, because I've had some success since then, whatever that means professionally, is that sometimes the crooked path or the side doors will get you there. Like you will use everything. I mean, I wrote a lot about that band experience in the book that just got published. Not only that, I based my entire marketing approach, which is how I make my living, on the lessons I learned playing in that punk rock band. So sometimes I guess it's such a cliche. Steve Jobs said it, right? But about the dots connecting, sometimes you don't know how the dots will connect, but it's pretty painful when you're in it, especially if you come from a family that prizes success and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I kind of gathered that you did just based on the UPenn thing, because I think that's pretty common in Indian culture, right? Like, we're very big on resume values, not eulogy values per se. Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's actually shift gears and start talking about the concepts in the book. But what I want to understand is, you know, how you sort of arrived at this framework for basically, you know, talking about hype.
Well, part of it was that, excuse me, after I was in that band and it didn't work out, you know, and it broke up, I got a job. I essentially got a very, very brass tacks sort of job just because I needed to make a living. And maybe because of that emphasis on resume values that were always there in my gut somewhere, even when I forgot about them, I did well. I worked hard, you know, I'm not a dummy. So I started to sort of climb the ladder and forget that it was supposed to be a temporary thing. And I ended up being there for 8 years. And it was the most brass tacks kind of thing. We ran customer service centers. It was a company called a business process outsourcing company that ran those call centers that are outsourced, that pick up the phone, you know, when you call in for customer service. And I learned a lot. I mean, in the first 3 years, I became an adult. I became a business person. I started to make a real living. But I only was there for 8 years out of fear. And by the end, I was very, very unhappy. And so I finally got the courage up to leave, which was difficult for me to get that courage together. But I figured I'd be a copywriter because I had read some articles about those opportunities and I was good at that. I was kind of the go-to guy at my job for that kind of stuff. And I figured because I was good at writing, I would just get writing jobs. And I didn't. I had about a year's worth of savings. I burnt through it. I was on the verge of a lot of financial trouble. And so what really happened was I thought back to that second half of me, that sort of mischievous punk rock half. And I've always been interested in weird stuff like cults and propaganda. I don't know why. It was just an interest of mine.
You know, you and me both.
Yeah. So I just figured, you know, I got nothing to lose. Why don't I try this kind of unconventional approach? We used to say when we were with the band, let's hype this up. We didn't say let's market it, right? So I was like, what if I think in terms of hyping stuff up instead of marketing it? And long story medium, it worked. I mean, I started to do well with the writing business, and then it turned into a business. The reason I came up with the book, though, was it was funny. In my interest in propaganda and all of this stuff, I read all of these strange books. So I was reading this book called The Crowd by Gustav Le Bon, which is this 1895 book of crowd psychology, trying to understand the Paris Commune. And I was watching one of the first Trump debates, and everyone thought he was a joke, and he was saying all of his Trump stuff. And I was reading the book at the same time, and I saw these connections, and I was like, this guy's going to win. So it just became, at that point, I just got fascinated that there's this universal set of principles that gets large numbers of people to almost act without knowing what's happening to them. And it just took off. It just started to foment from there.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the reason that I appreciated it so much was because of sort of, you know, the idea that it was unconventional, and, you know, a lot of it centers around questioning everything you're told. And I think part of the reason, you know, it was very resonant for me was because when I effectively did an about face from the entire online marketing world, Chris Ducker basically jokingly says, he's like, you basically told the entire online marketing world to go F themselves by not coming back to Blog World. I was like, I wouldn't go that far, but... You know, it was like the very same people we would have had as guests, you know, back when we were called Blogcast FM, we were suddenly turning down, right? You know? And I think that, you know, the way you started the book really struck me because it was a story about Gary Vaynerchuk. And, you know, my you know, like one of my most things that I'm proud of is that we've turned him down multiple times to be
good
a guest
you,
on our
man.
Show.
That's very cool.
So let's start there, because I think that that was really one of the big things that really struck me, because, you know, you open up the book by actually saying that you discovered pretty quickly that being good enough, you know, at what you do isn't enough to get people to buy what you're selling. And you open it with this first sort of idea of picking a fight. And the person that you chose to pick a fight with was Gary Vaynerchuk. So let's start there.
Well, yeah, that's very cool about turning Gary Vaynerchuk down. I think you're maybe the only person to ever do that, by the way.
Three times, by the way.
Yeah, that's impressive. Well, yeah, I mean, at the core of a lot of what I call hype, and just a lot of the things I've always been interested in, from punk rock to propaganda to cults, they bond with people, quote unquote, like them by pushing against people that they say aren't like them. And that's just a very, very, very powerful human dynamic that creates the spread of ideas and, you know, dedication to a movement. And I just always intuitively understood that, but I wasn't doing it. At the same time, I was honestly watching Gary Vaynerchuk very closely because you kind of can't avoid him. And also in my world, which was digital copywriting, he's everywhere. And I would just constantly hear him saying, hustle, 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 hustle. You need to work. He would literally tell young people to tweet from the toilet. And then I would think to myself, you know, this guy started a digital agency. He used to have a wine selling company, which seemed like a good company. But I would ask around and I would say, what campaigns has this agency worked on besides promoting Gary Vaynerchuk? And no one could tell me one. There might be one out there, but no one could tell me. Like Ogilvy and Mather, Crispin Porter Bagowski, you can find out what great campaigns they've worked on. So I started to say, why is this guy constantly telling young people to work around the clock and screaming at them to do it? And it hit me that maybe he's helping Gary Vaynerchuk more than he's helping these young people, and that this is happening just because it ties them to him, which is true. If you tell people to work on your behalf relentlessly, they will bond to you. That's a cult tactic. So I wrote an article in Inc. Called Why Gary Vaynerchuk is Flat Out Wrong. And I basically said respectfully that even though I think he's a good and talented business person, the advice he's giving people to throw brute force hours into tweeting all day long is not a very good strategy if you're trying to build something great and not just selling stuff. And he saw this and he flipped out. And I was no one at this time. I mean, I just happened to have a column in Inc. that I got through a friend and applied. And he recorded a video calling me out by name and chewing me out and getting very agitated. And then all his fans chewed me out. And it was like the start of my career. I mean, I got all these followers and people started to pay me money. So it was like, that was like a real lesson, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of nuance here, and I think it's a lesson in context, right? And this is something I've been writing a lot about, is that so often people tend to overlook context when it comes to the advice right. they get, particularly from people who are influential, because I know that you actually dissected the background of the wine store and, you know, mentioned the revenue, and it was like, okay, this isn't viable for most of the people he's giving exactly. this advice to. And then you also have this private interest problem, like when, you know, somebody like Gary or anybody else says, oh, everybody needs to be on this latest app. I'm like, yeah, of course they do. If that guy is an investor in it, he has every incentive to tell you that. Right. So why do you think people, you know, are so blind to context? Like, why do they ignore it?
I think because we all want answers, and we want simple answers. Or a better way to say it is, we want a rock to cling on to, right? Because life is challenging. Life is difficult. The idea, and we're raised on Hollywood movies and novels where if you have, let's just talk about entrepreneurs. If you have a really great idea and a great dream, you'll eventually work hard and overcome your obstacles and achieve that dream. And when you run into real life and you see that things are complicated and not everyone wins and life is difficult and sometimes there's a lot of loss in life, that doesn't fit that story. So if someone is out there with obvious credibility signifiers telling you that there's an A plus B plus C mechanism for achieving your dreams, and that person has done that, and that person looks like a superhero, we want to believe that. It feeds a lot of our insecurities and a lot of our fears. And context is complex. I mean, look at, I don't want to get political and I won't get into specifics, but look at the political situation. What wins? The simple, you know, bromides that people are throwing out there, or the complex policy procedure, the policy programs? It's always the simple sort of non-contextual stuff that wins the day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny because, you know, we teach a group of creatives in an Unmistakable Prime. And one thing I say over and over and over again to the people I teach is, I want you to consider the possibility that everything I am telling you is complete bullshit.
I love it.
Because, you know, in the context of your life, it might be. Like, this is why I always jokingly say the best Tim Ferriss experiment in the world would be to drop your kids off at his house for a week and see how his productivity strategies hold up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very funny because even a lot of the quote unquote gurus who I really admire, like, I really admire Ryan Holiday. You know, I think he's great. But I also know that he's playing the Ryan Holiday character. I don't think he's lying, but he's a writer. He smooths off the rough edges, you know, and that's natural. I mean, it's funny, even my book, right? I call it, there's a subtitle, 12 Indispensable Success Secrets, you know, et cetera. And part of that was to be funny because it's a hypey title. But part of it is that I know that people will respond to that. At the same time, in the final chapter, I say everything I'm telling you are a set of frameworks, but experimentation is key. These things are frameworks. You need to conduct small experiments and be open to anything happening, because that's the way the world operates in real life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I appreciated the fact that you said, you know, playing the character of Ryan Holiday, because I wrote this like 9,000 word article on Medium, which to this date, probably, you know, in the last year is probably my most popular piece about the psychology of building an audience. And I said, whether you like it or not, everybody who is a public figure is playing a character to some degree, because it's not appropriate to be 100% authentic, you know, and people don't like that idea because it's uncomfortable. But I think that makes a perfect segue to asking you about something in this first section. You said, you know, the most malicious people among us tend to have the most intuitive understanding of these principles. At the same time, most well-meaning people fail to understand or reject outright these psychological realities. As a result, harmful products, ideas, and ideologies tend to gain the most traction, while those that have the most potential to help people and move society forward often flounder. So how do we mitigate that?
So this is almost in some ways the question and the dilemma that it's at the heart of all my work and certainly of this book. So on one hand, the principles I'm talking about that I call hype, but really are, it's another way of saying mass psychology, right? Those stimuli that you can generate to get large numbers of people excited and emotional so that they'll do what you want them to do. If you strip those strategies of their context, they're not immoral or moral. They're just the way things work. I mean, you can pick a fight with an idea, not with another race, right? I mean, these strategies have no moral content. And that's obvious from the fact that even though it's a smaller number, a lot of extremely good people have used these strategies. I always use Martin Luther King because he's as close to a saint as we have in this country and as he should be, but he was a fantastic hype artist and mass manipulator. People don't want to hear that, but he wouldn't have done those peaceful protests if the media weren't there, right? So first, it's important to understand why the quote-unquote bad people are on average better at this. And so there's this cognitive scientist named Kathleen Taylor who studies brainwashing on a very nuanced level. And she presents this research that people with antisocial personality disorder, so that's that basket of psychological personality disorders that includes psychopathy and extreme narcissism, sociopathy, when they're put into a stressful situation, their heart rate doesn't go up as much as other people. So as a result, they're able to just act like, see the world as a chessboard and act accordingly. Whereas the rest of us allow our emotions to get into the way. So a lot of times we think that these tactics are bad. It's not that. It's that the bad people are able to act more deliberately. So what I advise is get as close to that state as you can without losing the good parts of yourself. And the way you do that is through emotional regulation, things like exercise, meditation, martial arts, green tea, whatever that thing is that allows you to therapy, whatever allows you to regulate your emotions. That is really how more people can get in touch with these strategies and tactics, because usually it's our emotions that get in the way of us being able to execute, even if we know what to do.
It's funny that you say that, because I know that, you know, you wrote about the seduction community, and I was, you know, a member of the seduction community. And when you're describing, you know, what you just did in terms of personality traits, I'm like, that's all the people who led these workshops.
And all of the enrollees, all of the followers tend to be people who let their emotions get in the way too much, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what it is, right? It's you talk about selling, you know, take the most vulnerable group of people, promise them, you know, the thing they want most, a bunch of guys who want to just get laid or meet, you know, the love of their life. And it's like, oh, these guys have a solution. Yeah, I'm all in. I mean, I spent 5 years on that. It was insane.
I'm curious. Yeah, I'm very curious that this is me interviewing you for a minute, because I wasn't actually in that community, but I was kind of shy with girls when I was young. And then I just sort of by trial and error learned what was a little bit more attractive. And usually it came down to confidence and being playful and being, but it seems to me that people who are naturally good at courting and dating don't become seduction coaches. It's the people who were bad at it who had to reverse engineer it. But am I wrong? I mean, that would be my
assumption. You're absolutely right. And the weird thing I think about that community that was so ironic is that, you know, I mean, Neil Strauss writes about this game. He said, you know, for as much as you know, these guys were good at getting laid, most of them couldn't keep a woman in their life.
Right.
You know? And the thing is, what I realized, you know, I did one of their boot camps back in the day, and I remember the guy who dropped me off the airport's like, what did you think? And I told him, I said, you know what? I've just spent 3 days with you. I don't know a fucking thing about you as a person. I barely even know your actual name. So I think you guys have a lot of problems here. That's my kind of immediate, you know, sort of assessment. I mean, the brainwashing is really, it's really powerful. I mean, Neil writes about this in the book where he talks about this concept of fractionation, right? Like you leave and then you come back and you get deeper in. And I mean, it took my friends probably 3 to 4 years before we finally were able to just get out of all of it together completely.
So it was kind of culty the way you're describing it. It wasn't
absolutely everything about it is everything about it basically used principles of cult psychology, which we'll talk about that because this is also something I'm incredibly fascinated by.
Yeah.
So we'll come back to that because I know you kind of get into that later in the book. So when you talk about this idea of picking a fight, you say there's nothing more effective for getting people to rally around a leader than the existence of a common enemy. While this doesn't mean you should go around calling people to commit acts of violence or cruelty, you will need to publicly take a bold stand about what you're against in addition to talking about what you're for. And I think that the reason that struck me was because people are terrified to do that.
Yeah.
They're so scared. Like Justine Musk once told me, she said, if you have a bold and compelling point of view, it's going to piss people off. And I can tell you firsthand, like we've had guests who have made listeners so angry. Like we had, a guy named David Wood, who was a coach here, a coach of some sort. And he started out the show talking about infidelity. One woman wrote me and basically said, I'm unsubscribing from the show. Your show is misogynistic and disrespectful, woman. How dare you put somebody like this on? And I said, look, we don't filter our guests.
Right.
What's ironic is that on the flip side of that, another woman hired that guy to be her coach. You know, same guest, two different interpretations. So, I mean, why is it that people are so scared to do this and how do they overcome that?
It's funny. There's a Kurt Vonnegut quote that I'll probably get wrong. He says, he's talking about writing, but he says, if you open a window and try to make love to the world, you'll catch a cold. So, I mean, I think we all want to be liked and we're afraid of getting in trouble. And sometimes there are repercussions. I mean, if you work in a corporate office and you take a bold stand, so many people's jobs are dependent on maintaining the status quo and not taking risks, despite all of their talk about disruption, that you'll be in jeopardy. And I think we're just programmed for all of the social, evolutionary, biological reasons that I know you talk about on your show and that your guests have, to want to be liked, to be accepted by the tribe, to not make people angry. I think we're terrified that we're going to get a bad grade. We start a business and we make people angry. Well, they could have bought from me. But the thing is, if you look at all of the people who are really successful, they all have people who dislike their point of view. I mean, Gary Vaynerchuk is a great example. I don't think it's a secret that I dislike his point of view very much. I think he actually is harmful to a lot of his acolytes, not on purpose, but I don't think he helps them. But he's a very, very, very rich man with very, very, very dedicated followers. And I know a lot of very middle of the road marketers and consultants who are struggling to get by. No one even knows who they are. So how do you get around it? I don't know. I feel like that's everyone's personal battle to fight. It depends. If I'm just hoping that I've made a compelling enough case and that other thinkers are making a compelling enough case about how important this is to stand for something, and that you can just get past your hangups. Just like I can't tell you how to have the courage to walk up to a woman in a bar. You can read the books all day long, but if you don't walk up to someone, you'll probably not have a date.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this whole idea of creating a secret society. You know, you said that what hype artists know is that secret cabals of powerful people who are helping each other out in the shadows really do exist. It was how Edward Bernays got America to eat bacon, how Andy Warhol got people to accept soup cans as art, and how Dr. Oz gets people to accept strawberries as teeth whitening, which I didn't know, by the way.
Yeah.
And no matter where you come from, how much money you have, or who you know when you start out, it's a method available to you. So how does this actually work? Like, let's just take, for example, I want to create a secret society for my listeners. What would that look like?
So what I find very funny, or at least interesting, is that so many people who are complaining about why they aren't creating things in the world say that they don't know people. It's who you know. It's the old boys network that they're not part of. And if you start thinking of powerful people that you want to get to know as human beings first, and start using some of the wonderful technologies not to just tweet around the clock, but to connect with these human beings, it's amazing how doable it is to become friends with interesting, important people who all have each other's back. So an example, and it's a lot easier to do now because, like, for example, before I had met you, Srini, you were kind of a celebrity in my world because in my, that's weird, right? But there's this niche of podcasters and of creativity thinkers in this very corner of the internet. And you are, I looked up to you in that way because I listened to your show. So you have credibility signifiers, you do good work, you have followers. But my, I don't know, 299 million of the 300 million people, if not more, don't know who you are. But that doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter. And you're connected with the same people, the powerful people in your space. You know Ryan Holiday, right? So
yeah, well, I always joke that I'm the most well-known, you know, I'm the most connected person that nobody has ever heard of.
Okay, so what I'm saying is people should focus on giving things to powerful people and important people that they have to give that's desirable to them, that's cheap for you to give up. So I'll give you an example. I mean, first of all, you have the podcast. So you can reach out to people and say, I'd like to interview you. And even if you didn't have a big following, which you do, even in the early days, you can say, I'm a big admirer of your work. I'd like to talk to X, Y, and Z. And you can, you know, my ego right now is puffed up because you're quoting from my book. I mean, there have been podcasters who just read a list of questions, right? So I think highly of you, right? So in other words, look for human connections. So one thing is something I used to do. I used to go on Twitter and I would monitor people that I was interested in meeting. And they would tweet their typical business stuff. And then sometimes they would tweet out something. And I'm using Twitter because that's what was big when I was doing this. But they would tweet out something that was very human about themselves. So one example is Brian Clark, the copy blogger guy. I saw that he was booking Henry Rollins as a speaker, and then he mentioned a band or two that was like an underground band. And I'm like, I think this guy likes the same kind of weird music I like. So I tweeted him something about that, and we became friendly, and we got to know each other, because that's a human connection. Now, if I would have gone up to him and said, you know, Brian, I'd like to pick your brain about the mechanics of blogging, I assure you, he would have not connected with me. So it's about connecting over human things and then doing what you would do with any friend, you know, helping them out, you know, networking 101. But first try to connect on that high level based on stuff that you can give them that only you have to give. And it's usually not money. It can be something for their kids. It can be knowledge that you have. And it works really, really well. It's very doable.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, I always said, you know, I met my first mentor, Greg Hartle, who has been a guest on the show multiple times. And I said, you know, people, the big mistake they make when, you know, connecting with, you know, influential people is they tend to look at metrics as opposed to who that person is. Greg had 150 followers. Like, he was 6 weeks in his project. And I only, like, I always, you know, basically will choose people like this based on something I'm curious about. I mean, that's like my number one filter for podcast guests too.
That's great.
Which makes book publicists insane. But yeah, I mean, you know, he, in the eyes of the internet, he was a nobody. Like, I mean, you couldn't find a trace of his existence even today. And he was by far the most influential person, you know, that had a really tangible impact on where we are.
I'll give you a similar but different example. So one of my very first clients after I started the agency is this guy, David Schreiner Khan, and he had an intern named Chris Weller, young guy, you know, still in college in his senior year. And when I've met a lot of interns in my day, but this kid, because he was a kid now, he's not now, then he's not now. It just was interesting. He just was an interesting speaker. He worked really hard. He just was interested in cool things. So I just always kept in touch with him over the years. And I would hold dinners and I would invite him and I would give him some advice. And over 10 years, I would just watch him get position after position after position. So now that my book came out, he is a senior editor at Business Insider. And I was just excerpted at Business Insider. but that's the other thing. Nice. Look for people who are interesting, play the long game. You know what I mean? Just like you did. Don't look just at those metrics. What can this person do for me right now? But sometimes you can just tell that someone's going to help you in a way that maybe you can't, that most people wouldn't see.
Well, let's talk about packaging. You know, you say that master hype artists understand that focusing on these sorts of details betrays a lack of understanding of the propaganda and the power of packaging. And you say when you're deciding on your own packaging, consider what gap of meaning or emotion or identity you can help with what you produce, then create a name, an image, and a message that people can latch onto and use to make themselves feel as if they're part of something vital and monumental. If you can do that, people will follow you anywhere you want to take them. And I think that, you know, why that struck me was in particular because that really, in a lot of ways, was the story of our rebrand from being a show about blogging to one about, you know, creativity. Because it was interesting. We would look at the iTunes reviews and people would say, this show is about a lot more than blogging, but, you know, I'm not sharing it with my, you know, friends because they're not interested in starting blogs, so they won't listen to it.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, can you expand on this whole idea of packaging and where do people get it wrong?
Yeah. So I think where people get it wrong is they say to themselves, you know, my website doesn't look very good, so I'm going to get a designed website. I need a better logo. I need better PowerPoint slides. Or maybe in their clothing, they say, I'm going to an important meeting, so I'll wear a suit. Or a little more subtly, I'm going to an important tech conference, so I'll wear clean sneakers and an expensive hoodie, right? So it's external surfaces. And while that's important, packaging can make you blend into the crowd as much as it can make you stand out and be noticed. If you know, we've talked about music a lot because I'm obviously interested in it, but also because I think genres like rock and roll and hip hop aren't really music. They're as much theater and entertainment and business as they are music. And the reason clothing, I mean, if you see jazz guys or reggae artists, I mean, I saw the Scottalites, these old reggae people, they were wearing like mesh caps and like whatever they woke up in, you know, but rock bands and pop bands and hip hop bands, their clothing says something about them. and they wear it all the time. So when Bono is in his techno experimental phase, he wore his wraparound sunglasses everywhere he went. And so what you want to do is think about, what are you trying to say in the world, and weave it through everything you do. So, and the best place to start with this, I think, is not your strengths. It's in the gaps. So you found it in the gaps of the blog comments. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to look at your weaknesses. So my favorite example of this is Andy Warhol. So Andy Warhol came into the art scene at a time where abstract expressionism was the predominant form of art. And the guys who created that were very manly men, you know, Jackson Pollock, very straight ahead kind of guys. And Andy Warhol, who was a kid in the 40s, had everything that a 1940s kid had everything going against him other than his artistic ability. He was extremely shy. He was gay, which at that time was a crime. He was pale. He was skinny. He was balding. And he didn't try to hide any of those things. He took them and flipped them into the core of his being, because he figured that there must have been other, quote unquote, freaks and weirdos like him. So why not package that for him? So he created this persona of shyness as an art. I mean, he would have these three-word answers that the press would ponder over for weeks. He wore a silver...
I remember, you know, reading about that.
Yeah. You know, he would wear a silver wig instead of like a toupee or like a bald hairdo. It's like, I'm bald, but look at this thing, right? So like, I guess it's thinking that there are all of these people out in the world just ready to follow you with all kinds of insecurities. And if you can be sort of the caricature version in everything you do of all of their longings and insecurities and you know, all of that, they'll go anywhere with you. And I think that's what you did. You created this home for creative people who were sort of not sure how to get where they wanted to go, maybe because of parental pressures, maybe because of being lost, all of these things. I mean, if you had just done a thing, here are the 10 steps to being creative, I don't think you would have done as well. But it's your whole, your admission that you tried it and did it the wrong way. You discovered surfing, the fact that you will say self-deprecating things like, I'm the most unknown, well-connected person in the world. I think for people like me and many other people, that's your packaging. That's your persona. And it gives us a home, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny you mentioned surfing, because like I remember even my old business partner, Brian, he said, I don't think that you would have had the sort of, you know, resonance you did with the audience without surfing, because he said it was this really bizarre element that is somewhat of, you know, a paradox to, you know, who you are in every other area of your life. Like, Indian people don't surf. Shit, we don't do anything athletic, you know,
I think it's a big part. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, yeah. I cut you off. What were you saying?
No. Other than play cricket. Like, that's apparently our most athletic pursuit. And that apparently takes some serious skill.
Yeah, a lot of really good Indian and Pakistani cricket players. That's true. Yeah.
Well, so I think that, you know, one thing I really loved was you talk about this idea of, you know, give the little babies their milk. And you talk about religion and you say, founders and early evangelists of new religions are faced with a formidable task. Even though we often come to accept the convoluted doctrines of world faiths, once they become mainstream, almost all of them strike people as bizarre, even dangerous when they first emerge. Yet some founders of new religions do manage to build massive followings around their belief systems, spawning leagues of followers who transform the founders' beliefs into the new status quo. And I love this because I'm guessing, given your interest in, you know, cults and the psychology of all this, you probably have seen the Nexium documentary. Yeah. And I was watching last night we were watching one on Scientology that Leah Remini has done. And, you know, I think that the question that really kind of emerged for me is, okay, great. Like, we understand this. And I think that that's one of the dangers of being in a position where people look up to you and admire you, is that you have the potential to abuse that power. You know, I know certainly that I've been in a position where I'm like, oh, I could abuse my power here, but that would compromise many of the things that I've done. And I see this all the time. And so I guess the question then is okay, how do you do that without becoming, you know, the next Keith Raniere and ending up, you know, in jail for 125 years?
So there's a lot here, right? I mean, I think these principles exist whether we want them to or not. And there are always going to be people who can figure them out. Usually the bad people, right? The Keith Raniere's. So the fact that you could have abused your power and didn't is why more people like you need to understand this stuff. So what really bothers me and has bothered me for a long time is that the people who intuitively understand mass psychology will often start cults and steal from people and promote bad ideas. Whereas the people who are very well-meaning, they're full of the kind of doubts you just expressed. Well, I can't really use these strategies because I might abuse them. Don't abuse mm-hmm. them. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like I was talking with somebody recently about something I was worried about with my daughter. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I was saying like, oh, you know, she's really spending too much time on the iPad because of this pandemic, but I've been a softie with her. Maybe I'm worried that I'm a bad dad, you know? And my friend was like, the fact that you're worried that you're a bad dad and you're trying to take steps to mitigate it is exactly why you're not a bad dad. So I think it's the same thing. I think more people who are well-meaning need to learn this stuff.
Mm, yeah. So yeah, I think that's so fascinating. So I wonder when you look at this, you know, specifically talking about this example, and you think about, you know, things like Landmark Forum, Tony Robbins, all these people, I mean, they're effectively employing, you know, mass persuasion tactics to get people to do things. You know, like I remember I went to Stephen Kotler's, you know, flow seminar. And one of the things he said is that it's something really dangerous. And I remember, I think I wrote an article about this. You might have commented on it about why we should never make major life decisions after peak experiences.
Oh, yeah, I think
but,
I did.
You know, you look at what happens in a seminar room, and what happens is, you know, these people basically put you in a state of flow. And then at the end of that, because you're in a state of flow, there's an upsell. And Kotler actually says the worst thing you can do when you're in flow is to make financial decisions. And yet so many people do. So, I mean, how do you resolve that sort of paradox? Because, like, you know, I don't think Tony Robbins has bad intentions per se, but I can tell you just from seeing, you know, things like Landmark, where, you know, I know a lot of people, I know because I've done Landmark, and,
yeah,
you know, the information is phenomenal. The organization is a shit show, but there are a lot of people who their whole life becomes Landmark. And then they, you know, Landmark says, oh, the only reason all the good things that have happened in your life are happening is because of us.
You might be asking the wrong guy, because I veer toward distrusting the sort of figures that play on those things. I mean, what I often tell
Oh, you and people, me both.
yeah. I mean, what I often tell people about Tony Robbins, I know a bunch of people have done Landmark, and I also saw a weird dedication that seemed unusual to me, you know. But with Tony Robbins mm-hmm. in particular, I'll often say to them, instead of following what Tony Robbins preaches, why don't you try following what he does? Because they're often at odds. So like Tony Robbins will tell all of the people in the audience this advice, but it's in some ways, for the reasons that you stated, the incentives are misaligned, because he's a marketer first and foremost. So the way he presents his advice is not just meant to give you the best possible advice. It's meant to get you in that flow state so that you buy more of his stuff. Otherwise, every person in that arena would be a millionaire, and most of them are not. Most of them are far from it, and most of them fall right back into a state of whatever misery they were in and then pay for Tony Robbins again. So maybe instead you should look at Tony Robbins and say, okay, this guy constantly promotes the fact that he does 7-hour talks where he doesn't take any breaks, because that creates a superhero dynamic. It makes him this magician, and we tend to follow people who can do astounding feats. So is there any way you can frame what you do as more astounding, as the packaged version of Ryan Holiday instead of the real Ryan Holiday? So what I would say is, yeah, learn from people what you can learn. But if you're susceptible to being swept away, start by looking at what they really do and see if there's a discrepancy.
Yeah. No, I love that so much. All right. So that makes a perfect segue to talking about this idea of, you know, being a trickster, which right off the bat, I think the, you know, immediate sort of reaction for most people would be like, a trickster, that sounds horrible. You say using the tools of the trickster is often the only way for those of us who start off without advantages to catch up. Fortunately, if you choose to avail yourself of this brand of benevolent mischief, which that is by far my favorite phrase in the entire book, like benevolent mischief, you can do so in a way that actually adds to the lives of those around you. So I guess, you know, how do we become, you know, benevolently mischievous?
I think a trickster is different than a liar. And I think our forefathers and foremothers were much wiser than us in this, because in every mythology, there's a trickster character. I mean, a lot of us know about Loki from the Avenger movies, but that's based on a real mythological character. And almost every culture has a trickster figure. And, you know, Christianity turns the trickster into Satan. But it was never a satanic character. It was somebody who played with was not a straight ahead. They always took the crooked road. They were a jokester. They caused mischief. But they always made the world better in the end. They usually were the god of art. You know, like Hermes is the trickster in Greek religion. And he invented the lyre, which was in Greek mythology, the first musical instrument. Right. So all of this nerdy research to say that if we really think about it, this thing I'm calling being a trickster or benevolent mischief, when not used to hurt people, makes the world a much more colorful and richer place. People used to say about P.T. Barnum that they really knew that his exhibits weren't real, you know, that they were kind of fake, but they didn't care because it was so much fun and it was always presented with a wink and a nod. So yeah. I think if you're starting in a position where you don't have the A plus B plus C equals D path to success, like if you went to Wharton or whatever, to come back to our earlier conversation, I think it's important to think about how to create that fun sense of benevolent mischief in a way that doesn't hurt people, but also to know when to shift. So actually, I think our friend Ryan Holiday did this wonderfully. I mean, he has this persona now, which is probably what he always wanted to do, where he's a very serious guy, a notably serious guy. I mean, he doesn't joke a lot. He talks about ancient Greek philosophy. He's very almost stern, not in a negative way, but he really calls you to task, and he's a writer and he's disciplined. But this guy started his career before he had, you know, I mean, I think his dad is a cop. I mean, he definitely didn't have an in. He was the guy who, you know, defaced his own billboards to get attention from Tucker Max. He had Sasha Gray on the American Apparel billboards naked for a clothing company. And what was so brilliant, he shifted. He said, he wrote a tell-all book saying, these are all the things I did to be mischievous. Don't do them. But if you do, use them wisely, wink, wink. And then he completely changed his image. Now, if he would have stayed a trickster, he would have ended up Dennis Rodman after a while. That's what you don't want to do.
You know? Dennis Rodman, who apparently can go to Vegas to hook up with Carmen Electra in the middle of the NBA finals and come back and still win.
I mean, you know, that version of the Bulls was ridiculous, but that's another story altogether. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So this is, you know, another thing that, you know, you talk about here is, you know, becoming a magus, and you say hype artists recognize what many of us do not, that we see as extraordinary qualities are often inverted weaknesses. The magus finds the gem buried in the dirt of his greatest weaknesses and broadcasts it to us as such. And, you know, to me, like when you say that, I can't help but think of Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's a great example.
So how do people do this, like, without becoming Trump?
I mean, it's funny. Well, Trump does it, but he almost doesn't know he's doing it. He knows he's doing a lot of the hype tactics he does. I mean, he's very good at hype. I mean, he has other problems, but he's very good at hype. But I think he actually thinks he's a superhero. Like, I believe that he believes that he is the greatest you know, the most fit president to ever take office, even though he weighs 350 pounds. You know, I mean, so he's a little bit diluted, although he does do that. I think maybe even a more attainable example is Thomas Edison, or a better model, because so here's the thing. If you're Tony Robbins, I mean, I don't know Tony Robbins, but when you see him, his very being is that of a superhero. He is massive. Yeah. You know, he is a gigantic man. He's built like a superhero. His voice booms. He speaks for 8 hours at a stretch. He lives in a castle. Okay, that's tough, right? But, you know, Thomas Edison was a guy who, when he came on the scene, he was the opposite of what people thought of as a scientist. Charles Darwin was a gentleman. I mean, he was, you know, nobility, and he used to take walks all day long and then like write for 4 hours and experiment, and had this very leisurely sort of pace. This idea of working around the clock to be an inventor sort of came from Thomas Edison. The other thing is, we think that he is a superhero because he invented recorded sound, electric light, movies. He really didn't. He didn't invent electric light. He perfected it. And even his perfection couldn't light more than a downtown area of New York City. He needed Tesla and Westinghouse to help with that. He couldn't figure out a way to commercialize the phonograph for 15 years. And it was a mistake that they made while trying to perfect the telegraph. So what he did was he hated socializing. He found it uncomfortable. He was partially deaf and he was just kind of cantankerous. So instead of fighting that trend, that tendency in himself, he flipped that into a strength. He said that he was so dedicated to inventing and making the world a better place in science that he was working around the clock. So he would get the press to circulate stories that someone came upon him at midnight in his lab and asleep at his desk and said, "Mr. Edison, you'd better come home." And he would say, "Oh yes, it is my wedding night after all." Right. So what I would say is people look up to extraordinary characters, but no one is an extraordinary character and everyone is an extraordinary character. So the idea is don't lie about who you are, but look at your life as faders. Take those things that people always compliment you about and dial up the attention on them, dial down the other stuff. And if you can't do that, or at the same time, make a list, write down all of the things you're insecure about, and then think about how can I flip that into a perceived strength? And it's a lot more doable than you might think.
Wow. So we kind of already alluded to the next sort of idea of finding a void and filling it kind of, you know, unintentionally. That's where we started. But I think the next piece that I loved was the whole idea of making it scientific. And there are two things that really struck me here. You said, you know, the real world, especially when it comes to human behavior, is messy. And this is uncomfortable for many people. Formulas, laws, and unchanging principles allow people to feel they have a bulwark against this chaos, and they will pay a lot for this feeling. And then you take the example of Simon Sinek, which I'd never really thought of, you know, him in this way, but it was just such a brilliant analysis that I was like, holy crap. You said that, you know, what makes his approach especially sophisticated is his use of pre-existing scientific vocabulary to add glitter to what might otherwise be a common sense and hence conundrum concepts. In this regard, he comes from a proud tradition. So, you know, explain this to us in more detail, because I that to me was just mind-blowing. I was like, wow, that's so true.
Well, something I found really interesting about Simon Sinek that I didn't know until I started doing research was his background. I mean, I always just assumed, because of the way he talks and always talks about dopamine and norepinephrine and whatever, and that he wears spectacles and he has that kind of half British accent, I just always assumed he was like a social scientist or something like that. Yeah. And his only working experience that I know of, that I can find, professional experience before becoming Simon Sinek, the author of Start With Why and multimillion dollar speaker, is advertising. I mean, he worked at big advertising agencies. He is 100% a professional marketer. So he's not a scientist. He's not a neurologist. He's not a cognitive behavioral guy. And he's giving a lot of advice about how people should live their lives, which might be great advice. I don't know, you know, but what he does is, so start with why. Is that really that bold of a statement? I mean, it's encouraging. It's great. I think it's fantastic. But he's basically just saying, you know, start, I mean, it's another way of saying love what you do, honestly.
Yeah.
But the way he talks about it, he talks about the release of various brain chemicals when you start this way. And he uses this, they call it in consulting, eye candy and ear candy. And people, you know, are very drawn, especially when it's said confidently, to heuristics. You know, we can't assess if someone is an expert every single time separately. So when someone speaks very confidently using high-flown language that's still understandable, we just assume that they're an expert. And so it's funny. If you have an idea that's truly, truly new, that can scare people. And in that case, you should introduce it very slowly. If you have an idea that's not new, that's really a lot like everybody else's, the best, but is useful and helpful, the best way to draw attention to that and drive emotion to it and hence sales is to be theatrical and to use scientific jargon. So it's almost counterintuitive. It's, you want to take the opposite approach depending on where you are on that spectrum.
So the first person that comes to mind when you mention that is Dave Asprey. Yeah.
I'm not as familiar. I know the name, but I'm not as familiar.
Yeah, so he does the whole bulletproof thing. And I remember, you know, somebody who I did a seminar with said, you know, the thing is that you can't use a sample size of one and call it science, but that's precisely what he's done. And he's done it really well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example.
Yeah. Okay, so the last piece of this, you know, you talk about sort of, you know, that there's two final pieces, right? Prayer and symbols, which I think that the thing that struck me out of the prayer and symbols thing was when you said, you know, you talked about Timothy Leary and you said, you know, what makes turn on, tune in, drop out especially effective is that it works on multiple levels. It certainly has all the hypnotic hallmarks of repetition, alliteration, and rhythm our brains readily respond to. At the same time, it provides marching orders to its audience. And, you know, I think that, you know, you see that, you know, sort of if you look at Mel Robbins and her whole, whatever the thing is, the 5-second rule. I mean, yeah. When I saw that, I was like, I started recognizing it everywhere.
It is so effective. Now, this is something that Trump does really well. I remember in the original debates, he was up there against Hillary Clinton and she would be like, go to Hillary.gov. I'm with her, you know, this and that. And he just will constantly repeat, make America great again. Like there'll be some crisis the latest scandal and he'll say, tweet out in capital letters, make America great again. And the idea is that language, it can mean anything to anybody. It's make America great again. So if you think America was great when Black people, you know, were in subservient roles, it can mean that. If you think America was great when factories were here and not in China, it can mean that. It can mean anything. And it's punchy, it's short, and he just repeats it and repeats it and repeats it. And we're wired to respond to that because, you know, that's how we learn language. Babies, think about what a baby needs to do. A baby needs to listen to a bunch of random noises made with a hole in your face. And within a year and a half to 3 years, turn that into a complex understanding. So your brain is running these statistics. So we're very attracted to things that on a biological level that make language parsable. And repetition is one of them. You know, rhyming. That's why we have rhymes. That's why we have alliteration. It makes the pattern recognition happen quicker and it lasts forever. So just never underestimate the power of simplicity and of linguistic devices and of repetition, repetition, repetition. You just burn things into people's brain that way.
Yeah. So I think when you talked about embracing theater and drama, and I think that what I loved here was the 30, you know, seven signals example about contrarian viewpoints. But I feel like that's what we've been talking about the entire time. And so in the interest of time, I want to talk about something that you say, you know, in this idea of setting a rock down to cling to. And the funny thing is, you know, because I'm writing this new self-published book that basically is questioning, you know, almost everything that comes out of the world of personal development and why I think a lot of it is misguided.
But we'll be reading that.
There are two things you say here. And you say that, you know, these books promise implicitly and sometimes explicitly, if you want to understand everything there is to know about gaining power, accumulating wealth, building relationships, becoming productive and efficient, there's no need to look anywhere other than between their pages. As such, their authors attain almost magical aura. I mean, part of the reason I kept that quote is I'm going to use it in my book because I was like, oh, I need that quote in my book. But, you know, I love that. So one, let's talk about that. So why do people buy into that aura? I mean, you know, I think it segues perfectly into the concept.
So this may be one of the things that gets you hate mail. So forgive me, but I'm not a very religious person. I mean, I was raised Jewish. I guess I still think of myself as Jewish because it's a culture as well as a religion. But I've always struggled believing in religion. And I remember thinking about Christianity, and I never understood when I was young why people believed it. It to me seemed really out there, far out. Like I couldn't wrap my head around why people felt that this was real. And then I remember just as I got older and had some, you know, as we all do, some tragedy in my life and some things like that, and looked at other people who had much worse tragedy in their lives, it just occurred to me how comforting and awesome is it. And this is not a comment on whether Christianity is true or not. I don't know if it's true or not. That being said, the idea that your wife can leave you, your children can die, your parents can die, you can go bankrupt, but Jesus will always love you, no matter what. No matter what, you can become a heroin addict, and Jesus loves you as much as he loves the president, right? And that is a rock. That is this unchanging thing. And I just think having that is just so appealing to people. So to bring that to the book example, people will write these business books or self-development books, and they think that because they write a book, it's going to get them attention, right? And speaking gigs and coaching gigs and all this. So they write some book. I mean, in my world, in the business book world, it might be leadership strategies for the 21st century. And then they wonder why no one is paying attention. What the real gurus do, the really big personal development and business authors do, they create a Bible. Not a religious Bible, but it's basically the implicit ideas. You can read this book and learn everything you want to know about everything. I mean, the 7 habits of highly effective people. It's learn these 7 habits and you will be a highly effective person. Full stop. That's all you need to know. Master these 7 things and you are effective at everything you'll do, you know? Or Atlas Shrugged. It's like a Bible for society. So like, even the 48 laws of power for people who love that book. I mean, these 48 laws will give you power. So if you can provide like an unchanging, a bulwark that is perceived to be unchanging, that gives you a lot of power. It really does.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, that was, you know, one of my favorites, in the book. So, you know, I want to basically come full circle talking sort of about, you know, cult psychology. Because you know, towards the end of the book, there are 2 things that you say. One is that, you know, if there's one lesson you should take from this book, it's to stop paying so much attention to the advice hype artists give and start modeling what they actually do. And nowhere is this truer, you know, than on the subject of work. But then you actually, you know, to bring us back to the whole seduction community thing. And it's funny, you know, when I read this, it was like that just, it suddenly, it was like a light bulb went on off my head of, oh, wow. Okay. I know, because I was one of these people who did exactly this. And, you know, you say that, you know, when these failed pickup artists had trouble understanding, you know, is that the most successful seducers never try to get anyone to do what they want to do. Instead, they create an atmosphere that gives people a sense of excitement and comfort, which allows them to decide for themselves whether they want to embark on a new adventure and do this mastery over one's, you know, to do this mastery over one's emotional state is essential. And you know, part of the reason I brought that example up is because I don't think that's just about pickup artists. Like if you want to build an audience, that's highly relevant.
Right. Now the piece you're speaking about is drawing people, it making them feel like they made the decision themselves. Which piece is it?
Yeah.
It's funny because someone wrote me an email. It was a sort of a fan email slash critique, and the person was right. And I wish I could fix this in the book. You know, you always see your mistakes. But what they said was they were confused about, on one hand, I was saying that you should give people commands and tell them what to do and they'll follow you. And on the other hand, I was saying that you should get people to make their own decisions. And I didn't really make clear in the book that those 2 things can exist simultaneously. So I think on a global level, if you sort of give people, you're not saying that, you're not telling them directly, but you're saying just to the world, this is the recipe for success, health, wealth, whatever. They'll follow that. But if you're sitting in a room with people or a group of people and you try and you create the perception that you're trying to maneuver them into doing something they don't want to do, especially if it's for your own benefit, not for their benefit, they will react. I mean, there's a concept called psychological reactance that I actually had in the first draft of the book, but then Jonah Berger's new book came out, which is really good, but he had a whole chapter on it. So I took out the term, but it's this concept that we are just wired. If people try to push us to do something and we perceive that they're doing it for their own benefit, they will push back even if it's good for them. And so, I don't know what question I'm answering, but I think you got to know that. I mean, I used to think that if someone wasn't doing what I wanted to do, I had a hang up about this, that I should push harder because it meant I was weak otherwise. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was the way I grew up or whatever, but you have to be strong. You got to push, you got to wheedle. But I realized that if you don't give people space to make their own decision and give them suggestions, if they're forced to do what you want them to do, they're going to sabotage you in the long run.
Yeah, no. So, wow, you really have packed this with so many, insights. Like, I mean, we went longer than we normally ever would, just because I feel like there's so much here. So obviously, I'm going to finish my final question, which I know you've heard me ask 1,000 times. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think for me, it's become, someone who finds side doors, I am always so attracted to people who think they have a recipe for life, find out that that recipe isn't going to get them to an unmistakable place, but aren't willing to settle for that. So they try all kinds of side doors. And that's what makes where they get to so unusual and weird. It's like someone was trying to become a novelist, but that didn't work out. So they tried every crazy side door and ended up inventing narrative video gaming. I mean, to use a random example, I always find those stories so amazing and those people so interesting that I think that those are the people I really find unmistakable.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your stories and your insights with us. This has been one of my favorite conversations I've had this year.
Well, thank you, Sri.
People find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything that you're up to.
Yeah, well, the book is in these crazy pandemic times, I mean, probably for most people, the easiest thing is to go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. I mean, if your bookstore carries it and you can get there, that's certainly an amazing thing to do. My work is in a couple of places. I mean, my company is called MicrofameMedia.com. That's a marketing agency. I call it a hype agency. MichaelFShine.com. One of the most fun things, or the things I enjoy the most, is there's a site that it's just a landing page called HypeReads.com. So I stole this idea from Ryan Holiday, but I twisted it through my punk rock lens. I mean, I was reading all of these strange, unusual, weird books of, not stoic philosophers, but cult leaders and rock managers and propaganda artists. So I make recommendations of those kind of books, and it's really become a community. We trade a lot of emails and have a lot of fun. So if you are interested in going deeper in these topics, that's a good way to do so.
Amazing. Well, like I said, this has been absolutely fantastic. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.